we sat down and in a meeting, and I talked about the sexual development, adolescent development, what I found was a tremendous resistance, even in the community, among the mentor mothers, to hear that. There's a tremendous resistance to thinking about sexuality, the issues of sexuality.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm a psychoanalyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. It's a special pleasure for me today to welcome Dr. Monisha Nair-Akhtar to our podcast. I have known Monisha for many years. We've worked together, as you'll hear. We are on the faculty of the same institutes. We've traveled to India together as part of her teaching program, which you'll hear about in the interview. It's a real pleasure. Dr. Nair-Akhtar did her adult and child psychoanalytic training at the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute, and she is a training and supervising analyst at the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and the Psychoanalytic Association of New York. She is, as you will hear about, the editor-in-chief and founder of a journal, Institutionalized Children, Explorations and Beyond. She's also on the editorial board of Psychoanalytic Inquiry and the Psychoanalytic Study of the Child. She is the author of two books, Play and Playfulness and Identities in Transition, The Growth and Development of a Multicultural Therapist. She is also the director of the Indian American Psychoanalytic Alliance. That is the program that I, along with other colleagues, have been involved in teaching very interested therapists in India online. And also a number of us attended a conference that Dr. Akhtar set up all on our own, I might add, in India last year. That was really a privilege. We will learn today about her work in offering psychoanalytic consultations to an orphanage in India and the profound impact her work has had there. Here is my interview. Monisha, welcome to the podcast. It's really a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Harvey.
Monisha, it seems to me that psychoanalytic thinking should have a central place in settings like orphanages. It has so much to contribute and also, of course, so much to learn in such settings about child development, about attachment, loss, and trauma and repetition, and certainly the intense transferences that develop from the kids to the staff, and I imagine from the staff to the kids. And yet, there's so little written about it in the analytic literature and likewise in the psychological and psychiatric literature. You have been a consultant to an orphanage in New Delhi, India, since 2012, and have really made this an important part of your life's work. Can you share with us your vision, what brought you to this work, what you've learned, what your encounters with the staff and the kids have been like, and what your sense is about what psychoanalytic thinking can contribute in such a setting?
Thank you, Harvey, for inviting me to share what has been a long 8-year project, going on 9 years now. And I got involved in this with this project beginning of 2012, you can say, and with a chance encounter, actually, with a colleague of mine from New Delhi, India, who was conducting a research project with a group of young girls in an orphanage. And she found an interesting theme amongst their dreams. So she asked me if I would be willing to consult with them and meet with the managing trustee, and I agreed to do that. So we began a series of conversations via Skype, and I learned the following. This is an orphanage that takes in boys and girls, and they take them in around 5 years of age and varying in age from 5, sometimes 8, 10, 12, depending on when the children are referred to the institution. So when they're young, they seem to do fine, living maybe 12 to 15 in a group home, girls and boys separated with two caretakers in each group home and mentor mothers, 4 to 5 at home that provide voluntary services to these organized, to the homes. But what would happen is that the kids would, you know, reach adolescence or pre-adolescent, and they would start to act out, getting into fights with each other, self-harm, promiscuity, running away, lying, doing poorly in school, all kinds of behavioral problems. So I asked you to tell me what brought the children in, like what were some of the referring questions or the referring things. What she said was, see, in India, you don't have to actually lose both parents or a parent to be referred to an orphanage. They were being referred because they were found abandoned on either on a railway platform, in someone's home, on the streets. And oftentimes these children had witnessed severe cases of trauma in terms of in their personal lives, ranging from either seeing parents being brutally, you know, a parent being brutally murdered, sexual abuse, neglect, being placed in one home, being transferred to another home. So there were several instances of children being abused and coming into the home, settling down. But once they reached adolescence or pre-adolescence, they began acting out. So I immediately suggested that we have some series of workshops. The staff, they had a small group of social workers who functioned as caseworkers for the organization. India is guided, has ratified the UN Convention of Rights, so they essentially have to file reports regularly for each child. But other than that, a caseworking kind of situation, none of the social workers were equipped to handle any of the problems that were coming up or to counsel the children or to work with the caregivers. And they readily agreed. So I set up a series of workshops on trauma, child development, adolescent development, attachment, looking at the kinds of issues that come up, and gradually introduced the group of social workers, initial group, this was in 2012, you could say, to some basic concepts of child development, but also the idea of the issues that come up, repetition, compulsion, as we see in children, you know, in adolescence, and defenses and the defensive structures, character.
And before this, they had no understanding of what they were seeing and what they were involved with?
No, they had no understanding. They believed, essentially what they believed is that if you gave them enough love, then they should be fine. That was the idea that, you know, essentially, so they really were not exposed or not trained or not introduced to any of these ideas that we hold so important in our work as in development.
I'm imagining that they were hungry for them.
Very, very hungry. So they asked me to come back, and I began a series of visits to New Delhi. And during those visits, I introduced various different kinds of workshops, you know, which got into depth, in depth about these, the concerns that they had, helping them to see, helping them to understand, working at first with the social workers, then bringing in the mentor mothers who had their own concerns. One of the interesting things is in India, it's a very hierarchical society. So you have a lot of situations where you have the caregivers really managing the children 24/7. But the mentor mothers have a great deal of say in what happens. So you would have a lot of pitting of the, you know, caregivers, mentor mothers against them, going to the mentor mothers, complaining, that kind of stuff. So it was really helping them to introduce them to some basic ideas of what was going on with the children and the caregivers and the staff, mentor mothers, as well as the social workers. So just really bringing that together, that was started the journey. And since then, we've had numerous workshops. There were two outcomes of this initial year. One was that there was a growing concern and an imperative need for a journal, for that region. India and the surrounding region, which is the SARC, we call the SARC region. That's the South Asian Association of Regional Collaboration, which includes the countries of India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bhutan, and Maldives. These countries actually collaborate on resources, teaching, workshops. So there's a spirit of give and take and sharing of ideas. So we thought what would be interesting is to really, and helpful, I think, for the region, was to start a journal that would start to show the kind of thing, concerns that, and there's a huge population of orphans in that area. And the government homes and the NGOs are just not equipped in terms of their understanding and their, what they know. So there's a growing concern. So he said, let's start a journal that would begin to examine some of these issues in detail. So we spent 1 year, actually 2 years, really structuring the journal. So I'm the editor-in-chief of that journal called Institutionalized Children Explorations and Beyond. So we structured it to look at the research issues and concerns in the region, SARC region. We call that our major research section. Then we have an interview with the leading authority internationally known, and which is a really revealing interview with their work and their experience, sharing their ideas. And then that's followed by a paper from the international section, contributions. We collaborate with the Scottish Journal. So we select articles from them. They also select articles from us. And that journal has been growing. We have an advisory board, an international board. And I use that journal as a platform to introduce more analytic psychoanalytic ideas, get several of my colleagues on the editorial board, advisory board, and have them contribute papers. So we have local people from here, analysts who have contributed. And that journal has grown enormously.
And we'll have a link to it at the bottom of the notes podcast. Are there clinical presentations as well?
Yeah, there are some clinical presentations in the journal. There's a lot of concern about the best practice. How do we care for them? How do we really develop and work with these children? So there are papers on that. And my goal was to really bring a journal that would serve the needs of the population, but also to have a international recognition so we can solicit input and get input, and also to bring in analytic ideas. Now, the Scottish Journal, interestingly, does have a lot of contribution from the Analytic Society as well.
You've mentioned that one of your contributions, I don't know if it was written up in the journal, it's about adolescents who leave the program and then struggle, they come back, they leave. Can you share that as a clinical example of what analytic thinking, how it can contribute to really the day-to-day work of the staff?
One of the things that we noticed with the young adults is when they turn 18, the government requires them to leave the homes and move out. So there was usually an increase of problems and behavioral problems just before children were leaving, and I could help them understand some of the precipitating factors, the dynamics, the separation anxiety, but also the enormous feelings of loss and trauma and destabilization, and the internal dynamics that were, were set in motion. Once the children would leave and they would go on as young adults in the community, we noticed, and this was as a result of a research project that was also initiated at that time that I was involved in, we assessed, there were very high levels of depression and anxiety in that group. But based on that and examining what their policies were, I suggested that they implement a series of programs and that would keep the young adults who had left connected with their home and caregivers in some fashion. So these were very simple. And so I had to, in meetings with the mentor mothers and with the staff, is talk to them about the dynamics, the things that happened. So we had one issue of the journal devoted entirely to leaving home. And in that, I explored the dynamic things that are precipitated in a child and in a young person, and the kinds of feelings that can come up. So that whole entire journal was devoted to looking at the kinds of issues that come up with young adults and the kinds of holding and containing environments that we can provide, even when they have left. So we implemented, and I'm very pleased to say that based on the research that we did and also the programs that we implemented, we were able to bring about some changes in policy so that the government could tweak some of their policies, and they created another intermediate group where the children, young adults, don't actually leave, but they're in that group and can still continue to receive services and help.
So do I understand what you're saying correctly, that by you're observing this clinical phenomena of what the leaving did internally to these kids when they left, you were not only able to make changes in the local group, but it actually translated upward so that the government was able to change their policy, affecting larger numbers of people? That's remarkable.
Yeah, and one of the ways, Harvey, that happens is that, see, in addition to the journal, what we decided is to serve the region, SARC region, we decided that we would put together a conference, a mental health conference for institutionalized children and serving their needs, things that come up with them, what's important for them. So that first conference we held in March of 2014, the year the first issue of the journal came out. So we coincided with that. And in that conference, we brought together people from different areas, right? And began to talk about these issues of leaving home, the issues of caregivers, which is the other issue that came up, training the caregivers who are at home. And I can explain that a little bit. But also we made it a point to invite people in the government. There's a real hierarchy, as I mentioned earlier. So we would invite the chief minister in that area, or we would invite, and we'll always have government dignitaries who would do the opening. But they became familiar. So every 2 years we hold this conference, and I have invited many speakers from the analytic community to be part of that. So what I do is really have used that platform to bring in ideas for mental health, for individuals, children, adolescents, and adults. Because the adults in this situation are not only the children and young people who grow up and leave the home, but also the caregivers who are in charge of their young children. They're oftentimes coming, leaving their families, coming to make a living, often get burnt out. Children can be demanding. The mentor mothers can be at times difficult to work with. So I suggested, and I introduced the paper, Selma Freybeck's paper on ghosts in the nursery. And I talked to them about how we have internal structures that can, if we are not attentive to them and understand what they are, come up in various situations and impact the work that we do. In mothering, it can be as a mother, right? And in caregivers, it can be there if their minds are preoccupied with their children, a young child that they have left home because they need to make a living. Then the way they interact with another child who is benefiting a great deal, the NGO, these orphanages do provide a lot of different and have access to a lot of services and schools. It comes out in various forms. So I suggested that we have in the mental health conference that we start including them in the dialogue. So the second time that we had the conference, which was 2016, we actually had an entire half-day session devoted to working with the caregivers, looking at their concerns, talking to them about different things, identifying what their issues were and what their concerns were, the first meetings. And what they found from the caregivers, and this was across all the homes coming in, that they felt they weren't heard by the institution, that, you know, the administration did not pay attention. So it was very timely for us to introduce that. So this was a big part of putting the journal, the mental health conference, and the workshops simultaneously. It's something that I did yearly and put in a great deal of time and energy into that.
Oh, I bet. I hear that phrase so often in meeting with analysts around the world who do work related to this. It's addressing the issue of being heard. And you're saying the caregivers were heard by your interest and attention to what their struggles were. And I can only imagine that that translated to their being able to hear their kids better. And so that the kids had an experience of feeling heard. You know, you go back to what they said when they were naive. They said, all you have to do is love people. Well, that's, you know, necessary but not sufficient. But hearing people in the way you're describing hearing people seems so vital in this work. You had mentioned one of the areas that you were able to be of help is young girls who were becoming sexual in this group setting, and how you helped the mothers help them negotiate how to deal with their growing sexuality.
This was actually a very interesting thing, because I'll give you a simple example that came up, an incident. We had this a group home of young girls that I learned that one day came to my attention from the managing trustee that they were really acting out. They were getting excited. We're really flirting with, you know, and fighting with each other, sexually very stimulated in ways that they couldn't understand, just giggly all over the place. Young girls, and, you know, how girls will do it.
Right.
So they were really, and they were baffled, and the mentor mothers were coming down hard on them. They said, what are you doing? You're misbehaving. The caregivers didn't know what to do. They had never seen this. So I asked them, has anything changed in the home? They said, well, you know, a few months ago, we actually have a male teacher, young male teacher, who's coming to the house to tutor. So I said, well, that explains a lot. And the male teacher apparently was tutoring few girls, but everyone wanted to be tutored by him. They all were cooking up problems, doing poorly in school all of a sudden. Well, they all wanted to be seen by him. So I could put that in context. And I said, first thing you need to do is remove that tutor, you know, get him, place him somewhere else. And so let me tell you why. So we sat down and in a meeting, and I talked about sexual development, adolescent development. What I found was a tremendous resistance, even in the community and among the mentor mothers, to hear that. There's a tremendous resistance to thinking about sexuality, the issues of sexuality. And I noticed that even in the questionnaires that we administered, which were somewhere on trauma, there are questions on sexual abuse, that they found it, the people who were assessing them, where the social workers could not respond to that. They would not be able to ask that question. This is part of the cultural setup in India, at least in New Delhi. My way of addressing that with them was to really bring it into the meetings and talk about development and talk about infantile sexuality and talk about how it appears throughout life, and how when you have adolescence and you have genital maturity, that you have to be extra, you know, careful about things and understand where it's coming from and the kinds of feelings, Oedipal feelings that you and I might think about might be stirred up, and their hunger for something. So some people could understand, but we could still bring about some changes based on what, you know, what we were observing. So it is a very difficult topic for them to talk about. It is a very difficult topic thing for them to even understand or to even, you know, think about young girls and young boys, how they can get easily stimulated and what it actually triggers and what are the issues behind it, the dynamics. Introducing them to these ideas and in a workshop talking about adolescent development and introducing them to concepts of that Peter Bloss writes about, the second individuation, and how all that emerges. So this gave them a context to begin to think about it, along with the changing body and how the body, if a child has been abused or traumatized, how that gets played out. And where, if you put a male tutor, that would the transference that would take place, and then the jealousy that would be stirred up amongst the girls. And then the counter-transference sometimes that one would see from the caregivers. So we would see a lot of different dynamics. You know, gradually we were able to bring up these ideas so that it's become more, you know, more a part of the lexicon and thinking about things. So they're much more able to do that. But what I'm trying to bring is that this idea that even with at the very top level, with the exception of the managing trustee, who is much more informed, but every mentor mother, extremely educated, well-meaning, but culturally there was a huge resistance. My way around that was to offer a course, a workshop on sexuality and gender to the community at large.
And how did that go?
It went very well, very well. But the issues were the same, because I had about 20 social workers and psychologists, some priests attending. And we had a wonderful discussion, but they all said that the problem was that the society was so blind and so rigid about these ideas that they never wanted to think about their adolescents. And these were adolescents growing up outside in the regular community, not in orphanages. And they were acting out and they were involved and, you know, they were dating and they were seeing, but the parents had a huge resistance to thinking about it.
You speak of your work there so tenderly. Can you share with us something about what leads you to this work? It is your home, India, but you're also here in America. Walk us through how this fits in with your life story.
I've been giving that a great deal of thought because, you know, when you're involved in something, you're just sort of immersed in it, right? I remember when I was a very young girl and I grew up in New Delhi, and I read David Copperfield by Dickens, and I was extremely moved by that book. So much so, it didn't occur to me when I wrote the first journal issue that came out of the ISED, which is the institutionalized journal. I actually wrote about David Copperfield and how that. So I had not put the two together, but when I was thinking about it, it occurred to me that that was really the turning point for me in terms of, as a young girl, it had a profound impact on me. And then later on contributed to some of my work in New Delhi, working with the blind in college and, you know, just volunteering my time. Later on, when I came to, I did my undergraduate at the University of Connecticut, in this country, I was introduced to the idea of deinstitutionalization. And I also, you know, which actually talks about, because I also worked at, as part of my research project, I worked at an institution for the mentally challenged, mentally retarded, they called them at that time, the Mansfield Training School in Connecticut. And I had a wonderful mentor, Jack Thaw, I believe his name was, who really, I spent a year there as part of my research project and was introduced and got heavily involved thinking about deinstitutionalization and what it actually meant, that removing children or removing people from institutions and placing them in the community, what that actually looked like. Now, moving forward, when I got into graduate school, I was introduced to René Spitz, his work on the orphanages in Romania. And then later on, I was a discussant for a paper written by a colleague of mine in Michigan, who wrote a paper on the Sri Lanka, the children and the adults who had been affected by the tsunami. And he does a lot of work. Alan Krohn, who is actually a psychoanalyst in Michigan. And I was a discussant for his paper. So at that time, I read a lot about Anna Freud and the work on the war nurseries, and her observations about peer relations and between what happens. And her response to that was to recommend really that the children be placed in a primary care facility. So, you know, a place with foster care parents. Now, all this was percolating in my brain, and I became more and more in my training as an analyst in Michigan, got heavily involved working with trauma or thinking about trauma and then attachment. So I read a lot of that, and that's my professional journey. And then later on, when the opportunity presented itself, I think I drew upon my family roots to give back to a country that, you know, had I felt given me so much. And from a country that I had learned a great deal, America has given me a tremendous education. And I wanted to give that back to the country that, you know, is my motherland. And that really comes from my family history. My father was a psychiatrist, and he believed a great deal in giving back to the community. He also did very well. But that was very much a part of my family structure. So when I went back, I brought those two trajectories in my work. So that's been my goal, is to really talk about the impact of deinstitutionalization, because I'm a firm believer in really strengthening the family. And helping families work with the issues that come up. Orphanages deal with the kinds of behavioral problems and concerns. And I think that as analysts, you know, we carry with us a lot of skills to hold, contain, provide emotional refueling when needed to communities, to these individuals, especially when you're working with trauma, to help them understand the impact of it, from project, you know, defenses that are stirred up, to counter transference, to trial identification issues that we use sometimes, to, you know, there are dreams that are affected, because the stories are horrific. So I think that that's kind of where I've drawn a lot of my the trajectory of my development.
Your love of the work comes across, and to share with the listening audience, I had the privilege to not only participate in your online teaching with therapy students in India, but I also, along with other colleagues, attended the Indian American Psychoanalytic Alliance meeting in Delhi last year, and I saw the impact that your work makes on so many people. I saw the hunger for learning that we referred to earlier in the students that you were working with, and their deep appreciation of what you are giving back to them, their patients, their professional lives, their country was palpable in the time I spent with them. You've answered the question I began, which is, so what does psychoanalysis have to contribute to orphanages? I had my ideas, but you have hands-on knowledge and you've taught us all. It's not only helping the children there, it's not only helping the staff, it's not only helping the local organization, but literally making an impact on a government-wide level to make the lives of the people there that much richer for them. Thanks so much for sharing this. We're going to include lots of this information in the liner notes so people can follow up with the journal. And I'm going to mention many of the things you've written about in my introduction. So, Monisha, it's a real pleasure. It's a real privilege. And thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you very much, Harvey. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.